From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a former Milwaukee psychiatrist looks at the science of PTSD in order to clear up some misconceptions. Then, as we approach the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing, astronomy contributor Gene Creighton thinks about the technology that had to be invented.
We needed a reliable machine that could carry such weight, and Saturn V was perfected. This was a rocket ship that was significantly bigger, even than the biggest rockets in 2019.
And our podcast on entrepreneurship speaks with Milwaukee native Andy Nunemaker.
Now, having been at six different companies, the language of business is really all the same, and it's quite basic. And if you start understanding that early on, you can pretty well succeed in almost any industry.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. It's good to have you with us. I'm Bonnie North. Today is Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Awareness Day. Mental health experts believe about 6 million people in the United States suffer from some degree of PTSD, a mental condition that wasn't even officially recognized by science until the 1980s. It now represents a significant public health issue among people as varied as combat veterans to small children growing up in violent homes. Dr. Shelley Jane is a psychiatrist and a PTSD specialist. She's now in California with the Stanford University School of Medicine, but she began her professional career in Milwaukee more than a decade ago. Her work in both places informs her new book, The Unspeakable Mind. She spoke with Mitch Tyke earlier this year and began by explaining how her personal history informs her work.
The field of traumatic stress is really personal to me. It took me a while to figure out how personal it was, but that has been a really important factor in kind of keeping my passion for this project and passion for my work, which is really tough work, not just on the clinical side, but the research side. So I discovered in 2007, my own family history was one of trauma and tragedy, and I got to know a lot more details from my own father about what happened during the 1947 partition of British India when my paternal grandfather was murdered. And I think in 2007, it just all really crystallized the impact it had on my own father, who was 10 at the time. He was forced to flee his home, live as a refugee, work as a child laborer. And even though 2 decades later, he ended up coming to England, and that was where I was born and raised, I definitely spent chunks of my youth living in the shadow that partition had cast on his life, and with a feeling that no matter how much I loved him and he loved me, a part of him had been forever changed by the events of 1947, and that part of him would remain inaccessible. So I feel like, you know, making sense of my own personal family history was really intertwined with the work that I do clinically and the research that I do, and was at the heart of this book as well.
And I gather he kind of told you more about his own story, partly in the hopes that you would continue to do important work.
Yeah, he did. I mean, you know, you meet a lot of people who have survived a major trauma, and a lot of them who develop resilience and kind of survive that trauma and transcend that trauma, part of the way they do it is by making meaning in this kind of search for meaning in life, that what happened had to have an outcome that was resolved in some way or did not go unaddressed in some way. And I think for my dad, education was key. You know, he was very pro-education at a time when it was not popular for an Indian man to be pro-education, especially for a daughter. But he was really pro-education. And then when I was very educated and very credentialed, then he was very pro, well, what are you going to do with your credentials? You know, how are you going to use the platform and the credentials you have to better the lives of people who have suffered the same as what your family suffered? I think essentially that was kind of what he was getting at. And it was food for thought for me. And really 2007 was that kind of turning point where I had to decide, okay, what am I going to do with these credentials?
Who do you think your audience is for this book? Who most needs to better grasp where science is in understanding and treating PTSD?
Well, I wrote this book for anyone who wants to know more about this important condition. And I would argue that PTSD is an inextricable part of all of our lives. If you just look at the statistics, the odds are there is someone in your life who you care about who has PTSD or some form of PTSD, you know, whether it's a partial PTSD or is really living with the consequences of a traumatic event. The statistics tell us that. So really, my goal was to take PTSD, which, you know, that term has very much become part and parcel of our modern vernacular. There's no doubt about that. In this post-9/11 era, we do use that phrase a lot, but it is often sloppily invoked. The term is still steeped in confusion or hearsay. And that's why I wrote The Unspeakable Mind, to really try and tell the complete story of PTSD in a way that is accessible for anyone who's curious to know about it. We've had such great science in the field of PTSD in the last 20 years. I mean, you know, talking from the perspective of someone who's a psychiatrist, just PTSD alone, the quality of the science, the growth of the science, very much in part because of the events of 9/11, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina, there's been this explosion in really high quality of science. And I don't think that is disseminated. I don't think people are aware of how much we know about PTSD and how much has shifted in the landscape, like literally in the last 30 years. I mean, the good news is what was considered once incurable and disabling is today a really treatable condition. We have a lot of reasons to be really optimistic and hopeful. And so I'm just hoping the way I wrote the book would be enticing to a really broad audience.
You do make the point. There's a really interesting chapter that gets at the idea that PTSD can be both overdiagnosed but also underrecognized. Even with our increased awareness of it, why is PTSD so hard to pin down?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's just the very nature of invisible wounds. You know, historically, if you just look at mental illness in general, invisible wounds, you know, the untrained eye can't see them. So it's hard to pinpoint something that you can't see kind of tangibly in a concrete way. So I think invisible wounds in general really kind of bring that dilemma. But we've got much better at diagnosing PTSD. We've got much better at defining what the core symptoms are. We've developed tools, clinical tools that can be used in anybody's office, you know, to screen for PTSD. I mean, of course, you've still got to be a well-trained clinician to diagnose it, but it's gotten much better. There's a lot more room to go. And I think that's what upsets me when sometimes it is overdiagnosed, it is overused, but at the same time, it's underdiagnosed. There's probably millions of people who are not getting diagnosed. So it's kind of holding those two opposing concepts in your head, you know, that it's both. It's sloppily invoked, overutilized, but at the same time, it's underutilized. So we've got to shift our attention to that population who are not getting diagnosed and make sure they get the resources and attention they need.
We should mention that many of the experiences, the patient interactions that you chronicle in this book were from your time practicing in Milwaukee, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was such a formative time in my career. You know, I trained at the Medical College of Wisconsin as a resident, and then I worked for Aurora Behavioral Health Services for about 5 years and had so many experiences that have shaped and moved me as a physician. So many people from different walks of life who had survived many different traumas, from sexual violence to family violence, you know, to surviving a major road traffic accident, all these different types of traumas. And then, of course, you know, the military population too, from working in the VA hospital in Milwaukee.
You mentioned the military population, and one of the things that I think might surprise many people as they read this book is that PTSD is not confined to veterans who saw combat. There are veterans with PTSD who developed it for a variety of reasons.
Well, absolutely. So, you know, when we think of trauma in the military context, obviously the first thought that comes to mind is combat. But military personnel can have many traumatic experiences outside of the role of combat, but whilst they're serving. So, for example, the first, you know, the thing that's coming more to the front these days is, you know, for example, military sexual trauma, you know, where a member of the military experiences either, you know, sexual harassment, sexual assault during the course of their military service. And that is something that is emerging as a significant problem in terms of the numbers, in terms of the statistics, the rates at which this is occurring, and then even the downstream consequences of that happening in terms of mental health consequences, consequences to physical health and general quality of life. So that's an example of something that is not combat, but still traumatic. And then, you know, obviously, when I meet a patient, I meet them as a whole, you know, I want to know about all of their life. And oftentimes, I mean, it was surprising to me when I was training to be a PTSD specialist, but it's actually not surprising at all. People have survived many traumas throughout many phases of their life. You know, if you look at the stats, 50% of Americans will say that at one point or another in their life, they have survived a major trauma. And a subset of them will have survived multiple traumas. So it's been fascinating for me to hear the full story of the life of a lot of my patients where, you know, they may have endured a major accident as a teenager or an episode of sexual violence before they even enrolled in the military. And then the important reason to know about these is because we know about this relationship between dose of trauma and PTSD, right? So the more and more trauma you're exposed to, the more you're likely to develop PTSD at some point in that journey. So these, being aware of trauma outside of the combat arena is really important as you get to understand your patient and understand what their risks are and how best to approach helping them.
How much do we know about how gender plays into the development of PTSD, either whether it develops or how it manifests itself?
So women are less likely to experience traumatic events when compared to men, but their rates of PTSD are 2 to 3 times higher. And there's a lot of theories as to why that is, but I do think a lot of it is down to the types of trauma that women are exposed to. You know, sexual assault and rape are much more common in women, and rape is actually the trauma most likely to lead to PTSD. It actually is more likely to lead to PTSD than even combat trauma or physical assault. So I definitely think a lot of that gender difference lies in the type of trauma that women are exposed to. And the other thing that's pretty clear from the data is that there's something about the way women's brains are either wired or either the way women are socialized, in that getting social support after trauma is really integral to how women heal after trauma. And so that's good news. You know, if we support women who have survived trauma, there's more chance that they will heal and get better and not develop PTSD. But on the other side, on the flip side, if they're denied social support for any reason, the consequences are kind of extra devastating. So, you know, if you look at everything in the context of the Me Too movement that's played out in the last couple of years, you know, not causing secondary injuries to victims, supporting them, empowering them to speak up, not shaming. There's a reason why this is really, really important, especially for women in helping them heal. So I think gender plays a really important role in PTSD, and we're kind of starting to understand a little bit of the nuance of that. So it's really exciting times in terms of tailoring treatments to help people from different backgrounds and different genders.
Well, and in terms of treatments, one of the points that you also make is that it is a mistake to think that there is a magic bullet to somehow make PTSD disappear.
Yeah. So the pragmatist in me, I don't believe in silver bullets. I feel like the traumatized brain is complex. Every human soul is unique. And in my experience, trauma to varying degrees has become part of the survivor's DNA. So to feel like you can just extricate it from them, like a sort of exorcism, I'm really skeptical. What's hard for me to watch is, though, a lot of my patients, obviously, they're suffering and they feel desperate. And my fear is that when treatments are kind of pitched as silver bullets, they're too hard to resist for people. But too often, these treatments that are pitched this way, they end up overpromising and under-delivering. And that's what's really tough for me to watch, when sufferers kind of forgo the tried and tested treatments, which are often you know, time consuming, or maybe they don't provide 100% relief, and they waste time and money on experimental treatments that haven't been thoroughly vetted. So that's what's hard for me to watch. Of course, if there was a silver bullet out there, I'd be the first one to be, you know, evangelizing about it. But I don't know. I think 20 years of being a clinician, like I said, I'm a pragmatist. I'm not sure I believe in silver bullets.
Well, and I know for some people there are medicines that play a key role in their treatment, but how do you approach the use of drugs versus talk therapy versus cognitive behavior therapy and other practices?
So that's a really great question, because this is where the field has really developed in the last 20 years, and I think it's really clear that talk therapies, there's a few talk therapies that come under that banner of CBT, as you just mentioned. So EMDR would be one, PE, which stands for prolonged exposure, is another. CPT, cognitive processing therapy, that's another. These, what we call trauma-focused psychotherapies, really work for PTSD. They really do, and not enough people have access to those treatments. We need to expand access to those treatments because the data is really impressive. They work. They have several magical ingredients in common, kind of exposure exercises, cognitive restructuring, education about trauma, anxiety management skills, so much good stuff packed into those treatment protocols, and they really, really do work. So in my mind as a psychiatrist, as someone who for the most part does psychiatric evaluation and I prescribe medication, I'll always say to patients with PTSD, you have to do the trauma-focused psychotherapy. And I'm always pushing for that because that is the gold standard. That is what I would want someone to have first. Now, for many reasons, that's not always an option for people. And then I will turn to medication. And we do have medications that really help people who have PTSD also. So, you know, and I often, a month doesn't go by when I don't witness a patient have a life-altering transformation on medication. So there's definitely a role for medication, but I always say you've got to try the talk therapy first. It takes longer. It's a little harder because you've got to do all these homework exercises and you've got to really look at your lifestyle and really implement a lot of changes. But you must try that because the data says that that works much more effectively. And we want to do that before we get into the realm of medications, which obviously come with their own side effects.
For as long as you've worked with people dealing with, or in some cases not dealing with PTSD, what still surprises you about this field?
That's a great question. I'm still in awe of the resilience of human beings, and I'm still in awe of how the power inherent in human beings to change. So I think the bravery of the people that I meet, that A, they survived whatever it is they survived. And as I mentioned, these are not insignificant traumas. These are life-threatening traumas that people have survived, sometimes not just once, two times, three times, four times. But A, their bravery in accepting that, oh, I'm not doing so great, and being able to come forward and then share that with a stranger and start to make attempts to kind of self-correct or overcome that. So that I feel is really interesting to me. And the zeal, I think, in the field, the scientists who are working towards improving ways that we diagnose and treat and understand PTSD, the clinicians who I work with day to day, their compassion and their empathy. These are the things I never tire of, especially in a world that is a little tough right now. We're living in a pretty fractured world where there's a lot of kind of them and us, and sometimes it can feel like there isn't a lot of empathy. I find so much reassurance in the people that I spend my day-to-day life with because they seem so committed to that, and they seem so to understand that even though the work is hard to do, this is really, really important.
Well, Shelley Jane, these are just really incredibly moving stories that you share with us in this book, and I appreciate so much that you spent some time with us and walked us through the issues.
It's absolutely my privilege to talk with you, Mitch. It's been really great.
Shelley Jane's newest book is called The Unspeakable Mind: Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. She's a psychiatrist who did her residency and was formerly in practice here in Milwaukee. Today, she's a clinical assistant professor with the Stanford University School of Medicine and a PTSD specialist. She spoke with Mitch Teich in May. Coming up, as we approach the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing, astronomy contributor Gene Creighton reflects on the technology that made it happen. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. On July 20th, 1969, American astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first humans to walk on the moon. The Apollo 11 mission was the pinnacle of NASA's decade-long efforts to conquer spaceflight, and it occurred just 8 years after President John F. Kennedy announced a national goal of landing a man on the moon by the end of the 1960s. Astronomy contributor Gene Creighton has been thinking about everything that had to be invented and perfected in order for that landing to happen, and she joins me in the studio now. Hey, Gene, how are you?
I'm great, Bonnie. How are you?
I'm doing fine. And I am reminded, because I'm old, that this is a very significant, or we're about to hit a very significant anniversary in the history of space and space travel.
I would say of humanity.
Of humanity, yeah. And it's huge. And that's 50 years ago, mm-hmm. we walked on the moon.
Yeah.
And I remember watching that on television. And I remember all of us kids getting pulled together, and we didn't have a TV in the house at the time. So we went to a neighbor's.
Wow.
And they had one of those big old console TVs, you know, with a tiny little screen. And it's that fuzzy black and white, you know, but we were just astounded.
Yeah, I'm sure. One of my dear friends says that her grandma, who at the time I think was in her 80s, she took a look at the television. She had seen the first car, the first airplane. She said, nope, this is too much for me. Nope.
I can't deal with it.
Yeah, I've seen the car. I've seen an airplane. Nope. Of course, subsequently, we've sent more people, but certainly many more machines we've sent to the very edges of the solar system. It is an amazing anniversary. Well, I'm sure there'll be, we'll have to take this in chunks, but I think our first step is to talk a little bit about what were the innovations that were necessary to do that bold, to make that bold technological feat happen, right? Because it was less than 10 years that people had to pull it all together and get a whole lot of technological advancements that simply weren't there. Now, you probably remember, many of our listeners will remember, but some won't, that the Soviet Union at that time, it looked like was quite ahead of the game. They had certainly built stronger, faster, better rockets. So the United States had some serious catch-up to do, and one of their main issues was to build a rocket ship, so a machine that could carry a significantly larger load than it had in the past. Because if you have people, it's not just the people, it's all the support systems that are really heavy, and there's all kinds of contingencies that you have to build in, because your tolerance for risk, if it's just a machine, is much higher than if you have people on board. So that was the first big thing. We needed a reliable machine that could carry such weight, and Saturn V was perfected. This was a rocket ship, a launch vehicle is the technical term, that was significantly bigger even than the biggest rockets in 2019.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. This was monumental. I mean, you can think of a really, really tall building, and that's how big the Saturn V stands, not to mention that it would burn hundreds of thousands of gallons of fuel a minute. So that was one big piece. And all that entails to figure out the correct fuel, all of that. The next thing that most people don't realize, I mean, the rocket is obvious. The second thing is not so obvious, and that is to communicate with such a machine, you need to be able to talk to it, yes, but you also need to be able to hear from it. And energy is at a premium. These rockets, these whole missions ran on a song, energetically speaking, so they wouldn't be able to boost, and you would understand that. They just didn't have the energy to boost the signal so that it's audible, if you will, from a normal receiving station. Not to mention that they only were visible for short periods of time at any given location on Earth. So the decision was made that there was going to be a network of these huge antennas around the world called the Deep Space Network. And that meant that there was continuous coverage, and you can imagine them as big ears. They could hear a very, very slim signal, and of course they could shout whatever commands that we needed to send. This didn't affect Apollo 11 quite as much as it affected Apollo 13, but we were able to save the people on Apollo 13 because of the Deep Space Network, and that is a critical piece of any kind of robotic work that we do if we send something to, say, Mars or, never mind, Pluto. Big ears, big mouth for the Deep Space Network. The third thing that was fascinating to read about. I've been studying all kinds of aspects of this exploration since, as you say, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary, was designing a lander. It turns out that there was a lot of argument among scientists and engineers. What is the best way to get a person to the moon? Is the best way to get them straight there? Is the best way to have an orbiting machine around the Earth and then somehow get some little piece of it to the moon, better to have the orbiter going around the moon and then having a little vehicle that goes from that to the surface of the moon and back? It all sounded pretty far-fetched. In the end, the last plan was the one that they chose. So they sent a spacecraft orbiting the moon, and from that, a little lander landed on the moon, and everybody kept their fingers crossed that they could get back on the orbiter and then come back to Earth. A lot of things had to go just right for that to take place. The weight was a significant problem. Rumor has it, if you look at some of the books, they said that they would spend, I think I'm saying this correctly, 10,000 hours to get 1 pound off the weight of the lander because it was so expensive. In the end, they did things like the walls of the lander were the thickness of 2 sheets of paper. Strong, of course, right? But very light, very thin. And they wanted to make the bare minimum that that's sufficient, but not a gram more than necessary. The other piece that I think is changed the life that we know now in everyday terms is that because of the weight restrictions, the computers that were used at the time had to be significantly reduced in size and in how much energy they spent. So, well, you might remember, computers used to be filling rooms, right? They were absolutely enormous things, and they needed to be shrunk by a factor of 20,000 to get the job done. So that tendency toward minimization has carried to this day, and our electronics are continuously getting smaller and smaller, more agile, more energy efficient, more reliable, and that will perhaps enable us, or certainly will help, to get us to Mars.
You know, I was thinking about the size of computers, and I remember when I first saw a computer, it was at Dartmouth College, and it literally took up a couple of rooms, and it was ice cold because it had to be kept cold, and they had punch cards that it. So you had to put in cards that was the programming that made it actually do whatever the thing is that you needed it to do. And when you think that you took something like that and in a very short time shrunk it down, maybe not as small as the cell phone that I'm holding now, but significantly smaller so that it could go
to the moon.
Right.
I mean, that's astounding. And, you know, one of the things I think really made it possible was will. It was political and cultural will to make it happen.
Yes.
Because otherwise it would never have happened.
That's right.
We would have never put the resources into it. We would have never, you know, achieved what we achieved in that short amount of time.
That's right. So, you know, now the comparison is different because the will probably isn't quite there to spend that kind of money on that time scale. But so many people are still interested in space exploration. And there's also now potential for some commercialization in that maybe there can be fruitful ways for industry and government, public funding to make, you know, our next adventures possible.
Let's hope.
Yes.
Let's hope. Well, we'll talk more about this next month on the actual anniversary. But until then, Jean Creighton, it's always great to see you.
Thank you so much.
Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium, which is located on the UW-Milwaukee campus. She is our regular astronomy contributor. Tonight at the Hagerty Museum of Art, six artists are participating in a roundtable discussion called Production and Reproduction, Being a Parent and an Artist. The conversation was inspired by the work of Milwaukee-based artist Makiel Flamini, who received a 2018 Mary Knoll Fund Emerging Artist Fellowship. Lake Effect's Susan Bentz ran into Flamini and her family at an unlikely spot, last weekend's Energy Fair in rural central Wisconsin. Flamini, who's a mother of two young children, who has described herself as a mom who hasn't slept in 4 years, told Susan about the inspiration for her exhibit.
So I made drawings all with like pencil and crayon, but basically the title of my show was How About I Eat You? And it was based on a dream that Orla had had about, she had this dream that all these animals were chasing her home from school. And then she said she got to the house and she was really scared, but then she turned around and looked at the cheetah and said, How About I Eat You? And I just thought it's so amazing because to, you know, to like turn on a predator and say, you know, maybe I'm powerful, maybe I'll eat you instead. And so I really liked that. And I was making the work about, it was sort of about motherhood in a sense, but also like reckoning with the things, the person you were before versus the person you are after, and trying to change and trying to see the things about yourself that aren't so good, and like, you know, just becoming a mom basically. And like, because I don't think I was ever really beholden to anything before kids, obviously. I mean, if I had a plant and a diet, I could just throw it outside. I mean, you do? Okay.
Speaking of.
Yeah.
This is perfect.
All right, hang on a
second.
Well,
I'm going to come over and see. Okay. So, you've had the grand opening.
The opening, yep, was on the 6th.
Do you have any other, do you have events throughout?
So there's a panel that I'm on next week. I think it's the 27th, I want to say. Cool. And it's called Production and Reproduction. And so it's a panel of all women who've won the award that had little kids at the time they won it. So it's about, like, how do you be an artist and a mother, or how do you manage that? Which, you know, now after all the work I did, I realized maybe I'll just say you can't at the panel.
But you're doing it.
I stopped making work actually after I had kids, and my friend just had a baby, and she said, "How did you do it?" And I said, "I didn't. I just accepted that I couldn't like it for a while," and that really helped. I think if you struggle too hard, you're not happy anyway, so you might as well just. But now I've went back to painting now, but.
Makiel Flamini is a Milwaukee-based artist. She's currently a Mary Knoll Fund Fellow in the Emerging Artist category. Flamini and five fellow artists will discuss the balancing act of being both artists and parents this evening at the Hagerty Museum of Art. That's where Flamini's work is currently being exhibited, along with all of the other Knoll Award winners. Lake Effect Susan Bentz spoke with Flamini at last weekend's 30th anniversary Energy Fair in Custer, Wisconsin. We will take one last break and then return with our podcast on entrepreneurship and innovation called How Did You Do That? This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. It's time now for our monthly segment on entrepreneurship.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen is the executive director of the Milwaukee Institute, and I'm Tim Keane.
Tim is founder and director of Golden Angel Investors, and this is How Did You Do That? A show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded.
You know, it's interesting because right up until the day I left GE, you would have never used the word entrepreneur to describe me, right? Maybe I had some entrepreneurial traits, but I was the big company guy, you know, the brand name school guy, and just following that path.
Milwaukee native Andy Nunnemaker went to school in electrical engineering and business at some of our country's top universities and held high-level jobs at two of its biggest companies. After running major operations for GE Healthcare, first in Australia and New Zealand, then for all of Southeast Asia, Andy was deep into a career as a very successful corporate executive. But then came a moment when he was presented with a life-changing situation.
My co-host, Tim Keane, who had known Andy for more than a decade, approached him with an opportunity. Would he leave GE Healthcare to run a small startup called EM Systems that provided emergency medical services software and didn't have any profits?
Andy jumped at the opportunity, and he's never looked back. He ran EM Systems for 7.5 years and engineered a sale to Florida-based Intermedics that got investors more than 10 times their money back. Andy then ran Dynamis Software until its sale in 2018 at a price that gave investors nearly 4 times their money back. Andy, welcome to How Did You Do That?
Thanks. Happy to be here.
You got an undergraduate degree at Valparaiso and a master's degree at Georgia Tech, both in electrical engineering. But you never worked as an engineer. Why not?
You know, that's true. I actually had an internship and 6 different co-op opportunities, all in engineering. As I was going through those, I realized I really didn't like engineering. I had gone into it because my high school guidance counselor said I was good at math and science and should do engineering. And I kind of blindly went forward. But once I realized I didn't like the work, I knew it was time to look for something new.
Can you define when you switched out of that engineering mode? Did you kind of look at some jobs and decide, or how did you?
Yeah, I really didn't have experience outside of the engineering co-ops, but I had friends that were going into other lines of work and friends that were going into business. And I actually heard about a program from SBC Corporation, the company that's now AT&T, that they were hiring for a leadership training development program where they would give you a year in business, a year in sales, a year in operations, a year in finance. And I thought, well, that's a way to jump into business because that's what I think I want to do.
But you had an engineering degree. How did you talk them into hiring you into that program?
Yeah, it was maybe a little bit serendipitous. I went to a career fair at a convention center in Atlanta with thousands of other people, waited in line a half hour, walked up to the booth and said, hey, I'm Andy. They took my resume, they looked at it and said, okay, engineering, decent GPA. They said, well, we're not really hiring for technical positions, and we'll keep your resume on file, which is code for they're going to take it and throw it away the minute I walk away. So at that moment, I turned back and said, well, I understand you're not hiring for technical roles, but are you hiring leaders? Because if you look at the bottom half of my resume, that's who I really am. And that's where it went into talking about things like founding the Sigma Chi chapter at Valparaiso and leading efforts to change the Georgia state flag at Georgia Tech, et cetera, et cetera. And as we talked about those leadership opportunities, I became animated. My recruiter, Nancy Zeltman, said, hey, let's go back behind the curtain and do a full-on interview. And next thing you know, I was at their corporate headquarters in Dallas.
And how long were you there for?
I was there for 3.5 years. So I completed my 3-year rotation, a year in sales, a year in operations, a year in finance, and then went back and got a sales job out of that program. And I actually had been going to SMU to take MBA classes just to broaden my business knowledge. I never had an accounting class. I never had a finance class. It was all just engineering. And a friend of mine, Brad, got into Harvard Business School. I said, well, geez, Brad, if you got in, I could probably get in. So I applied and went off to Harvard the next year.
What'd you get out of that experience? What was the most valuable thing from your MBA?
You know what? I think the most surprising thing for me was the level of collaboration at Harvard Business School. I'd heard all the stories and thought, oh, this is going to be cutthroat and, you know, everyone's seeing the paper chase, you know, where everyone's competing against each other. And it was really a collaborative environment. In fact, we weren't allowed to disclose our grades to employers and they weren't allowed to ask. So that really fostered a teamwork approach. And that's the approach that I've taken in business ever since. So that was extremely refreshing and definitely against the preconceived notions I had going in.
So when you graduated in when?
1998.
Everybody was going into consulting or investment banking, right, in 1998. How is it that you wound up at GE Healthcare?
Yeah, you know, everyone was. And fortunately for me, I had learned from my internship opportunity and that experience. So I actually did a short summer internship between my years at Harvard, and I did an internship in consulting. Thank God I did that. That's how I realized I didn't really like consulting either. And, you know, I'd had a great time at SBC. I really liked that environment. So I wanted to go into an operating company. And at the time, GE was the most respected company in the world. So I thought, I'm going to give it a shot and try to get a job at GE.
So you were one of the few Harvard MBAs who really wanted to do business.
Yeah, I guess at the year I graduated, over 800 of us graduated and only two went into GE operational companies.
Did the fact that the GE Healthcare job brought you back to Milwaukee, did that play in? Did you want to get back here?
I was indifferent at the time. I actually used the fact that I was from Milwaukee to try to get an in with GE Healthcare. I figured they'd know I was serious if I was trying to get a job from Milwaukee. So I played into that with the interview. But I'd lived all over the country and frankly didn't expect to come back to Milwaukee. So it was really GE that brought me back here for good.
So what happened at GE? You worked for Dennis Cook, as I recall, in Six Sigma. And how did that kind of play out for you?
Yeah, when I was interviewing, I was given a plethora of jobs. And Dennis's job was the one that really stood out. And it was mostly because of him, not because of the job. It was a quality leader job in the Six Sigma program. But Dennis was the type of leader and the type of boss that he brought a great team together. And then he gave us his undivided attention. We felt like part of his job was making sure that our careers were successful. And we would just, you know, go to the ends of the earth for him. I remember we'd stay late. We'd stay till 11 p.m. working on pitches and things and wouldn't really think twice about it because we knew he had our back. And every interaction we had with him was about career planning and what's your next job going to be. So, I mean, that was his leadership style, and I certainly learned a lot from him.
What was your next job? Where did he help you get to in GE?
Yeah, he actually, within a year of getting to GE, he helped find my next job, which was running the manufacturing plant at their headquarters in Waukesha. And the deal he made at that time with the vice president of manufacturing is, okay, you can have Andy for this job, but his next job has to be somewhere else, in sales or in service. So he was really trying to get me that broad experience within GE across the functions early on in my career. And he was a career coach right until the day I left GE.
So I need to ask this question of both of you guys. I feel like I'm interviewing both of you. Andy, when you were in your 20s, you met Tim, and Tim had a group of about six young people who he was bringing together periodically. You were talking about big ideas, leadership, technology. How did that influence you when years later you decided to leave GE for a startup?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of this is right place, right time, right? The reason I got my sweet job in Australia running GE Healthcare because I was in the room with Jack Welch at the right time. So a little bit of luck played into that. And I was frankly lucky to have met Tim Keane long ago, and we had a decade-long relationship so that when the opportunity of EM Systems came up, you know, Tim already knew who I was. I certainly knew and trusted Tim. And I think that's, you know, in life you make your own luck, but the way you do that is by putting yourself out there in situations like that.
So, Tim, what made you think Andy would be so good at this?
Well, I think when you're hiring people, it's pretty easy to get fooled in a couple of interviews or three or four interviews or multiple interviews, especially if the person you're talking to really wants the job. But I had known Andy for years at this point and knew his leadership traits because we'd spent a lot of time talking about all that stuff over that period of time. So I knew that this would be something that I thought he might want to do. And so I think the question to you is, how did all of that experience, what happened at EM Systems that you were able to put all this to work for.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. EM Systems, it's when you're running a company, it's like running a P&L at a bigger business. And the fact that I'd had some of that P&L experience in the past by running entire operations certainly was helpful. But to me, it's the basic blocking and tackling and the basic business tenets. So what I've learned now having been at six different companies, the language of business is really all the same, and it's quite basic. And if you start understanding that early on, you can pretty well succeed in almost any industry. So for me, a lot of this was just the basic elements of business and doing the right thing. Like you said, Tim, it's easy to fool someone in a half-hour interview. At EM Systems, we had 12 employees before we ever had to go out to a job board and hire someone we didn't know. Our first 12 employees, we knew. We all had one degree of separation from all of them from day one. Same with Dynamis. Our CTO was someone I'd known for decades. Our vice president of sales was someone I'd known for decades. And I think when you put these elements of business into practice, you're going to succeed.
But you had a big, great career going, and it was secure. You threw that all. How did you calibrate that decision, knowing you were walking into a startup with a couple employees, you were going to be taking out the trash? How did you calibrate that decision?
Yeah,
take that risk?
For me, whenever I approach decisions like this, I mean, look, my internships, my co-ops were with the U.S. government, and my parents thought I was crazy for leaving that because it's the safest place in the world. And I went to the phone company, which is, you know, one degree above a bureaucracy. And when I left that, they thought I was crazy. Now I think they've learned, you know, don't question this. But here's the way I approach it. When I'm looking at a decision, a big decision like this, I look at it through the lens of 10 or 20 years into the future. Am I going to look back and have regret because I didn't take that opportunity? And so for me, it was a no-brainer. At GE, I knew exactly what my career path was. I knew what jobs, I knew what scale, what scope, what pay, and I knew I could always go back and get back on that train if something happened. If EM Systems would have failed, I could have just gone back to corporate America and gotten another big job. So to me, there really wasn't a lot of risk.
Okay, but how about that moment when it was 11 o'clock at night, you were late on a deadline, everybody else left, and you were sitting at your startup. Didn't you think, boy, if I were back at GE, this would be easier?
No, because I was doing it, I was doing it for myself, not for someone else. And that's the thing about startups. It's funny. People say, oh, now that you're your own boss, you can set your own hours. It's not like that, right? You're a captive to the business in those lean first years, and you are there all hours, and that's just the way it is. But you're doing it for yourself, right? And you're answering to yourself, and you're holding yourself accountable. To me, that's exciting. That's invigorating. Now, you know, we've sold EM Systems, and I worked for Intermedics for 2 years. We sold Dynamis, and now I'm working for Applied Systems. I can work for other people. It's not that, but there's something about that energy, and when it's on the line and you have to make payroll, that's invigorating.
So if you think back, so I bet our listeners would like to hear an answer to this. If you think back to EM Systems and to Dynamis and you think of the one toughest situation, can you tell us a little bit about generally what that was and what you might have done about it?
Well, I can think of learning opportunities. So when we started EM Systems, there was a philosophy that we had to create EBITDA from day one, right?
EBITDA being cash flow?
Positive
earnings, right? Obviously, you need cash flow to make payroll, but positive earnings because the convention said businesses sell on multiples of EBITDA and EBITDA growth. And so we produced EBITDA. But looking back, had we poured all of that investment back into the commercialization and grown that sales team, we might have done even better than a 10 times return that we did. So in my mind, I say, okay, lesson learned. And when we did Dynamis, right, we scaled up the commercial operation, hired the sales team, but we did it prematurely. We didn't have the product fully baked, right? And so I think the lesson is you can't – one size doesn't fit all, and you can't have a cookie-cutter approach, and you really have to understand the business and make decisions relevant for the business. If I could go back in time, I would have done both of those things differently.
Hey, I want to switch gears a little bit. Yeah. What you've become known for recently in Milwaukee is your work with the Symphony. You were on the board for a long time. You became chair about 5 years ago, right about when it was clear the Symphony was in big trouble. Can you tell us how you got the Symphony out of trouble?
Well, yeah, obviously it takes a village, right? And this was a team effort. But I took the same approach that I'd always taken in my career. When you jump into a new job, you know, you take the first 30 days to just ask questions and assess the situation. Take the next 30 days to come up with a game plan. And you take the last 30 days to socialize that game plan. And then you execute it on it for as long as you're in that role. So that's what we did at the Symphony. And within, you know, the first 30 days, we realized we had a structural deficit of $4 million a year. That was not sustainable. So we came up with a plan. And then we went to the community and asked the community if they were ready to implement that plan. And it happened to include asking for what's turning out to be $140 million from the community, 90 to build a new hall, 20 to double the endowment, 6 to pay off the pension, and the bridge funding along the way to get us to financial sustainability. Fortunately, the answer was yes, and the community gave us a resounding yes. We've already raised over $115 million on our way to $140 million. And the building's halfway done. So to me, you know, that's just rewarding, and seeing the city respond to a crisis like this of one of its, you know, cultural treasures and say, yes, the Symphony is important, just like the parks are important and the sports teams and everything that makes Milwaukee a great place to live. And for me to play a small role in that has been extremely rewarding.
One more question for you. Would you do another startup?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've learned something about myself over time. Back when we started EM Systems, I didn't have any reputational risk. I didn't really have a lot of financial risk. I had a little 401k from GE, and that was about it. You know, so for me, that wasn't risky. When it came time to start Dynamis, I'd had somewhat of a reputation. I had a little nest egg that was put at risk. And what I've learned is my risk tolerance has gone down over time. So I don't know if I'd ever do another pure startup. I think I'm more accustomed now to relative risk rather than binary risk, where a startup is either going to fail or succeed. Other types of businesses have more relevant risk, and I think that's what my risk profile looks like right now.
You can read more about this story and find links to resources by visiting wuwm.com.
And listen to all our podcasts at WUWM at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that is all the time we have for Lake Effect today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of the show right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.